You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 5th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Coming up on today's programme, NATO's new Nordic trio launched their first training exercise in conjunction with the alliance. Portuguese politicians enter the final frantic few days of campaigning ahead of Sunday's elections.
With the far right looming in the background, Portugal is heading to the polls this Sunday in what has been described as the most decisive elections in recent history. We'll assess how the campaign is going so far.
With Austria's ex-chancellor Sebastian Kurz serving a suspended sentence after having been found guilty of lying to parliament, what next for the country's politics?
Sebastian Kurz, he was famous for message control in every kind of interview, every kind of output that he had in any form, in any medium. So it's kind of fascinating to see how this like really slips away from him.
Plus, the latest business news and a special look at the fate of the department store in the United States. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Vincent McAvinney. On Sunday, a two-week NATO exercise, Operation Nordic Response 2024, kicked off, with new members Finland and Sweden taking part. Over 20,000 troops are on exercise across northern Sweden, Norway and Finland, with more than 50 ships and 200 planes involved. Bruno Kaufmann is the Swiss Broadcasting Company's Global Democracy Correspondent. Bruno, thank you for joining us from Stockholm. Firstly, what exactly will this exercise involve?
Yes, hello, Vincent. Yes, this exercise is basically, you can say, an extension version of cold response, which have been done every year in spring in northern Norway. Norway has been a member of NATO since 1949. And now with Finland in NATO and Sweden joining, this has been extended to cold response. And this is now transnationally over the all of the area of northern Scandinavia. This is a geopolitically very important region towards Russia. And here now, you can say the exercise is about bringing in troops from the West, from Northern America, which has been on the way for weeks, and now joining Norwegian, Swedish and Finnish troops, vessels, airplanes, to show how they can cooperate in a way of a response of a collective defense exercise.
And they're very, obviously, northern where they're doing this exercise. Is that a particular thing that they're practicing? Arctic warfare, cold warfare?
Sure. I mean, when the temperatures are below minus 20, minus 30 degrees, you have to do this in a different way than you are in spring weather or in summer weather. So these troops are, of course, specialists in this kind of very, very harsh situations. And now with Norway joining hands with Finland and Sweden, of course, the power of this exercise is much bigger than it has been until now.
And while Sweden and Finland have only just joined the alliance, did these three countries already have sort of strong defense cooperation?
I would say yes and no. I mean, no when it comes to Norway and Sweden and Finland, because this was really the border of NATO to non-NATO land for many, many years. On the other side, Sweden and Finland have in recent years really joined hands, had a lot of collective treaties to work together. And this was also the reason for Sweden then, which initially after the attack of Russia to Ukraine didn't want to join NATO. When Finland decided to join NATO, for Sweden, this was the clear response to also give in to this issue and to be a member of NATO, because Finland is so crucial for Sweden. And so now you can say for the very, very first time in history, all the Nordic countries are under the same defense umbrella. And this is truly historic, because there has been so many attempts after Second World War, again after the Cold War, and now they are together.
And has there been any increase in activity along the Norway, Finland, Russia border at all?
In fact, just a few minutes ago, Reuters had a note about that Russia was enforcing their forces on the western border. This is a follow-up to a recent decision by President Vladimir Putin to rearrange its commandos on the west side by establishing again the traditional forms of commandos in Moscow, and he called also the Leningrad Military District. Just observe the name. So this response by Moscow is not surprising, and you can already, when you are, for instance, on the Norwegian border town of Kirkenes, you can watch over to Russia, and there you hear paramilitary groups exercising. So obviously there is a response from the east side.
And this exercise is part of a wider NATO one running over several months called Steadfast Defender. What are we likely to see during that?
Yes, there is a huge amount of exercises and maneuvers now going on. It started already a few months ago when the North American forces departed towards the North Atlantic. And we will now more and more see that this exercises move to more the Baltic Sea region, to the Baltic countries, but also to continental Europe with Poland as a main field. So it's clear that NATO now wants to show that their different member states can cooperate, their different forces can cooperate together, that their commandos are working and that their defense is efficient vis-a-vis a very, very aggressive Russia.
Mm. And you know, looking at Sweden, a new member, it's technically still not fully actually in NATO, although everything has finally been approved. Is that affecting the exercises in any particular way?
Not really, of course, because this has been also going on for months and years now that this cooperation has started. But it's still, of course, formally the case that Sweden is not part of this Article 5 reinsurance of NATO. So in this moment, Sweden geopolitically is still in a gray zone, even if now all member states, all the other 31 member states have ratified. But still there are some formal steps. And as we have learned in recent months and years, there can be technicalities, there can be somebody really stopping something, which makes it difficult to really bring the flag of Sweden up at the NATO headquarters in Brussels. But at this moment, of course, also in Sweden, everybody expects that to happen in the days and weeks to come.
Bruno, thank you. That was the Swiss Broadcasting Company's Bruno Kaufmann. Now here's Sophie Monaghan-Coombs with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Vincent. Chinese Premier Li Qiang has announced an ambitious 5% growth target for 2024 and vowed to transform the nation's economy. China also pledged a 7.2% increase in defence spending and dropped references to peaceful reunification with Taiwan at the National People's Congress opening today. Americans are heading to the polls in 15 states and one territory today for Super Tuesday. Joe Biden and Donald Trump are widely expected to win the primary elections, potentially sealing their respective party nominations for president. The European Commission is releasing its European Defence Industrial Strategy, designed to boost defence manufacturing across the bloc. Estonia, France and Poland have all called on Brussels to pledge larger sums to help reindustrialise the European defence base. And American Airlines has ordered 260 new aircraft from Airbus, Boeing and Embraer in one of the biggest plane orders in its history. America now holds orders for 440 aircraft in total, with options and purchase rights for 193 more. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Vincent.
Thank you, Sophie. On Sunday, voters in Portugal go to the polls with a far-right candidate seemingly likely to win on the 50th anniversary of the end of Portugal's dictatorship. Joining me now in the studio is Monocle's senior foreign correspondent, Carlosa Rebelo. Carlosa, what's brought about this election first?
Well, so we have to take a step back. This is an early election that was called after the collapse back in November of António Costa's socialist government. The best way to simplify things and explain what happened was there was an ongoing investigation over some members of his cabinet, not implicating him directly, but the public prosecutors put out a statement basically saying that in some wiretapping, the name of the prime minister had been mentioned. So he said, well, if that is the case, even though he wasn't charged or anything or formally accused, he said, if that's the case, obviously I can't continue in this post because I think the office of prime minister needs to be respected. So he stepped down, triggering this whole thing. In the meantime, it has emerged that he was not involved. It was a different name that was heard. So it has opened an entire different conversation about, you know, the fact that the public prosecution's office could, in this case, it brought down a majority government for absolutely no reason. So that's a broader conversation that's happening on the sidelines of this about the power and the separation between the judicial and legislative arms of government.
I'm sure that will have sparked a few conspiracy theories as well.
Of course.
For listeners who may not be aware, though, of the leading candidates in this election,
yeah,
Andre Ventura and his party Chega, which is translated as meaning enough. Who is he and what does this party stand for?
Yes, so Chega is a far-right party in Portugal, which has been around for the past couple of elections, but clearly gaining traction as time has gone by. It is expected that he will double the result it got in 2022. So in 2022, Chega had 7.2% of the vote. It's tracking, according to the latest polls, at 16%. And obviously, that's fluctuating and changing. Now, Chega wouldn't outright win, but it would have a significant percentage that it could become the kingmakers in the election. The latest polling, which came out just earlier this week, puts the socialists and the coalition on the right, the Alternativa Democrática, Aliança Democrática, on the right, in a technical tie. So they're within 3% points of difference, which is within that margin. So in this scenario, Chega could become the kingmaker so that there could be a government on the right. Now, we know that the socialists have been in power now for a couple of years. There is fears by analysts of what this shift towards the right could mean for the country. There's been an increase in the minimum wage. There's been issues to deal with the housing crisis that they've been trying to tackle. Portugal really has improved over the past decade. And there is fears of what this complete shift to the right might mean. But as we know, when a party is in power for too long, the change tends to be drastic. It tends to swing from one end of the political spectrum to the other. So at the moment, everything is kind of neck and neck for us to be able to actually determine what's going to happen on election day. And the Portuguese people are heading to the polls on Sunday. But we saw this past Sunday what we call the early voting, which you can require and request if you are not in the country or not in your polling area on the day of the election. And it was the record number of, it might not sound like a lot, but 200,000 people that showed up and requested that. And we've never had that amount of people requesting it. So there is high hopes that the number of people voting will also be quite high this time around.
Mm. And in terms of just dividing into sort of the social policies and the economic policies, I mean, how far right are we talking? Where is sort of Andre Ventura on the map of European politicians?
Well, he's quite down with the far right spectrum. You know, this is a party that believes that some of the freedoms enshrined in the constitution should be curtailed, that values religion, which is something that has been separated from the state for a long time. There's quite an interesting discourse happening here because, as you mentioned, Portugal is celebrating 50 years of the fall of the dictatorship this year, on the 25th of April. And the prospect of André Ventura being in government has been described as essentially not being able to celebrate those 50 years fully because it will be a return to a lot of those, for lack of better word, old school values that were last seen during that time. So we're talking about putting family, faith, and above all else. Even from an animal rights point of view, it's a party that supports wolf fighting, which is something that we've been trying to, in Portugal, curtail for the past couple of years. It is a tricky position. And, the right-wing candidates, not only on the far right, but also on the center right, seem to be talking about perhaps having a referendum on to ban free abortion, which is something that in Portugal has been legal for nearly 20 years now.
So a lot, something when France is putting it in its constitution.
Exactly.
That's
so
the conversation.
There's a lot of conversations about all these constitutional rights that have been in the Portuguese legislation for at least two decades. That if this government with the coalition of the far right goes in, there's at least a serious case for referendums or for debates to be opened up over issues that in the minds of a lot of people had been settled long ago. And as with every far-right party, Chega is not an exception here by having a quite strong anti-immigrant rhetoric and sentiment. Mm. And as you may know, in Portugal, one of the things that the country prouds itself the most is that after the fall of the dictatorship, there was an open door policy to the former Portuguese colonies that were given independence to try to bolster those bilateral ties. So it is quite painful with the backdrop of the celebration of the end of the dictatorship to be talking about these issues now.
Mm. And turning to the other side, so the other parties, particularly ones at the left, I mean, why have they struggled so much? Not just because obviously they've been in power for so long, but also a particular issue with the youth vote.
Yes. So with the youth vote, it has always been difficult to capture. And there is quite a sense that this election's youth vote could be determinant, particularly the youth vote of the expats abroad. So Portugal has had a brain drain. The vast majority was forced to leave under the Social Democrats, so the centre-right party. Of course, a lot of people have left during the Socialist Party too. And the perception of what's happening back home really does change when you think about, you know, you being an immigrant in a different country, forced to leave because there was no opportunity.
This is sort of the wake of the 2008 crash.
Exactly. Yeah. So there is quite a big number of people that think that the youth vote could really swing the election. We need to remember that at least the expat community only elects four MPs. So it's not enough to make a decisive change, but traditionally have always been the same party. So we might see some change there.
Carlota Rebello, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Last month, a court in Vienna found Austria's ex-chancellor Sebastian Kurz guilty of lying to Parliament about the appointment of a former ally as head of the state holding company and gave him an 8-month suspended sentence. Once seen as the future of European politics, he will appeal, but even if he does and is acquitted, the chances of him mounting a political comeback in a general election later this year are looking increasingly unlikely. So, with the era of Kurz now almost certainly over, what does it mean for Austrian political culture? Monocle's Alexei Korolev in Vienna reports.
Worum ging es? Es ging eine Aussage in einem parlamentarischen Untersuchungsausschuss.
Das haben wir ja gerade ausführlich berichtet.
Das heißt, der Prozess.
Sebastian Kurz faced constant accusations of cronyism and corruption throughout his time in office. He is now a convicted perjurer. But in a national television interview soon after the verdict, Kurz was still maintaining that he had done nothing wrong, that he had been singled out for punishment, that he was the victim.
Unfair. Ich habe mein Jusstudium nicht fertig gemacht, aber ich habe im Jusstudium gelernt, vor dem Gesetz ist jeder gleich. Mein Eindruck ist,
it's true, there were some other politicians, also former federal chancellors who were convicted, but it is the first time that a high politician is convicted because of false testimony at a parliamentary committee.
Robert Kert is professor of criminal law at the Vienna University of Economics and Business.
It's so new for the Austrian politics that a wrong saying of a politician is a criminal offense or is seen as a criminal offense. For Mr. Kurz, it was always very important to have an image of a smart politician who always says the truth. And this is completely the opposite of what we see.
Sebastian Kurz, he was famous for message control in every kind of interview, every kind of output that you had in any form, in any medium. So it's kind of fascinating to see how this like really slips away from him.
Felix Hafner and Jennifer Weiss are founding members of the Institute for Media, Politics and Theatre, a Vienna-based collective of playwrights and journalists. Its latest project is a series of documentary plays called I Am From Austria.
Each part is about a whole different topic that we research.
Yes, so we have like 5 episodes, and the first one was about corruption and this whole Kurz era, also about the recent process, of course. And that's really important that they said now that he's guilty, because it's also a public symbolic shame for him, kind of. And you know, Austria has been speculating about the possible return of Sebastian Kurz. And I think there have been ideas around it, because there has been like a big absurd movie premiere around him and other PR stunts that kind of led to a sort of return of Sebastian Kurz. So the biggest thing about this verdict is that the possibility of him coming back into the political scene in Austria has become very small.
A political comeback may be off the cards, but this isn't the last we'll be seeing of Sebastian Kurz. He is still under investigation for allegedly using public funds to buy favourable media coverage, something he denies. But there's another thing. Now that he has become living proof that lying has consequences, will other Austrian politicians take the hint? A last word to Professor Robert Kett.
The influence of criminal law is always very limited, and it is especially limited in relation to politicians, because in normal political life, we are used that politicians do not say everything they know. In principle, I think it could have the consequence that many people will not say anything before these parliamentary committees. On the other hand, I always say in discussions, even if it does not work, it's important for democracy.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Alexei Korolev, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Time now for a business update with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts, who joins us from Dubai. Ewan, good to have you on the show. China has set a pretty ambitious growth target for 2024.
Hello, Vincent. Yes, they've set their economic growth target at around 5% for this year. It's about the same as last year, which they just about met, assuming you trust the veracity of the figures. China calls the figure ambitious this year. Chinese Premier Li Qiang acknowledging the challenges facing the economy. He says it won't be easy meeting the targets, and he says that we need policy support and joint efforts from all fronts. And that's the key point, really. How much support and government heft will there be behind these targets? Chinese stocks listed in Hong Kong don't seem to have a lot of faith in them. They sold off today. Investors, I think, a little bit disappointed at the lack of ambition at the target, but mostly they're concerned about the lack of concrete measures put in place to boost growth in the world's second largest economy. Remember, Chinese economic problems are many. They have a problem with unemployment, particularly youth unemployment, and that hugely indebted property sector, something which has been hanging over the economy for years now. There's not really an easy solution to that. A lot of companies teetering on the edge of insolvency, loads of unfinished properties. There's a lot of problems with people not buying properties because they're worried about the property market in China. And that is a big chunk of the economy, and that is really weighing on economic growth. More growth is important for China because it has ambitious plans for all sorts of things. There's been, of course, enormous progress in the Chinese economy over recent decades, but there are still lots of people living on not very much money, and the Chinese government very keen to do something about that. So Chinese growth is a key metric for the government there. And of course, they are very keen to get to this target. But I think investors want to see more being done to actually get there.
Mm. And there's debate raging among investors about the current buoyant state of global stock markets.
Yeah. Are we in the midst of a stock market bubble? Two very well-known analysts come down on either side of this debate. JP Morgan's chief market strategist reckons that the dramatic rally in US equities we've seen over the last few months and Bitcoin's rapid surge above $60,000 signal that, yes, investors should be a bit worried. Whereas chief US equity analyst at Goldman Sachs is amongst those who thinks that the risk on mood is warranted arguing that big tech's lofty valuations are supported by the fundamentals. Put in plain English, it means that they're making lots and lots of money, and therefore they're worth a lot. It's all been driven, of course, by the Magnificent Seven. This is the phrase that we've been talking about a lot in the recent months. We're even calling it the Mag Seven these days. Amazon, Apple, Alphabet, the Google parent company, Microsoft, the world's most valuable company, the owner of Facebook and Instagram, Meta, the chip maker, Nvidia, and Tesla, although the latter has had a bit of a ropey patch over recent months. So far, the financial results are justifying the moves. Earnings per share for these seven stocks has risen a combined 59% in the latest quarter compared to a year ago. That was handily beating the estimates that analysts were penciling in. So far, these stocks over the last year have risen by 80%. So this has been an enormous rally in these tech stocks. Some of the rest of the market has been doing quite well as well, but so many of the gains we've seen are driven just by these seven stocks.
Ewan Potts, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio.
Tune in to Monocle on Culture, where we grill our panel of critics to get the inside line on the best in the world of film, music, art, literature, and more.
It's just got this synth section that kind of makes you want to swing through the saloon doors straight to the dance floor.
With industry insiders and the odd bit of reportage too, it's bound to keep the most discerning of culture vultures very well fed.
Why'd You Come In Here Looking Like That is a song that is absolutely going to make you want to put on a pair of tight jeans and go boot scooting, even if it's just in your front room.
Monocle on Culture, premiering Mondays at 20:00 London time and available thereafter wherever you get your podcasts.
Finally today, we're heading to New York, where Macy's has its flagship store on Manhattan's Herald Square. The struggling retail giant has recently, though, announced the closure of some 150 stores, with a plan to lean into luxury and in-store experience. However, the company's shares surged yesterday on news of a renewed takeover bid from Ark House Management and Brigade Capital. We're joined now by Jordan Holman, New York Times business reporter covering the retail industry. Jordan, thank you for joining us. Macy's had some 650 locations just 5 years ago, and this new round of closures means its footprint has almost halved. What's gone wrong with the company?
Absolutely. So this has been a years-long struggle for Macy's, just trying to attract a new shopper base that does want to go to its large department stores and its malls. They have increasingly been struggling against this e-commerce world that we find ourselves in. And so management has tried to shrink the amount of stores it has, just focusing on its most foot traffic stores while closing the other ones that are in dying malls.
And the new CEO, Tony Spring, has unveiled what he's dubbed his bold new chapter strategy to save the stores. What exactly will this involve?
Yeah, so it involves the store closures. So they're planning on closing 150 stores over 3 years. So by the end of 2026, they would have about 350 stores, which is roughly half the amount of stores they had going into the pandemic. Also, they're just trying to make the shopping experience better at Macy's. You hear a lot of people complain about messy stores, not great merchandise. You can never find someone at the fitting room or when it's time to check out. And so Tony Spring has said he's trying to increase staffing levels at those areas around the fitting rooms and the shoe department when you really do need staff, and also just making the stores look better. So the plan is, once they close the stores, sell those 150 stores, sell off that real estate, that will leave them money to reinvest in the stores that they have remaining.
And speaking of real estate, why are these investment firms after the company? Do they want to keep it as a going concession, or are they just after its property portfolio?
Yeah, so Ark House Management and Brigade Capital Management have been really pressuring Macy's to turn around its business since December. And so when I chatted with Ark House over the weekend, they said they are interested in keeping Macy's as a retailer. They just want to have it take it private so it kind of gets out of the spotlight of the public markets. But they are fascinated in the real estate. Macy's is the largest department store in the US. It has a massive footprint, and they think that real estate can actually be an asset. So when they looked at Tony Spring's strategy of closing stores, that's actually frightening to them. They want to keep that large store base, but they think they can do a better job running it as a retailer.
And finally, we've seen Sears and JCPenney fall into bankruptcy and liquidation over recent years. Is it over for the department store model in the US, or do the hundreds of brands who have products in them want to see them keep going?
I think a lot of people think there is room for a department store model. It just really has to be responsive to younger shoppers, to having a really strong e-commerce model, because people do like going to stores. The majority of retail spending happens in stores. What department stores need to figure out is how to get people back to the stores, how to make it a fun experience again. And so that's the struggle that Macy's is up against. You mentioned those other stores went away. And so Macy's does have an opportunity to capitalize on being one of the last few department store chains left.
Jordan, thank you. That was Jordan Holman. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Chris Chermak. Our researcher was Neoma Ekwe. And our studio manager was Steph Chungu. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.